Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 150.
The big 150.
It was a big 150.
Yes. Wow.
Yeah.
Did you think you'd ever get here?
I don't know.
Halfway to 300?
Yeah. No, I did. I don't know if I thought about how I'd be here at 150, but here we are, Lon.
I mean,
this is almost 3 years, actually, since we've started this podcast.
It's a lot of good conversations. A
lot of conversations, including this one with our good friends. Who are our friends, Lon?
At Tiltpixel, yes. I think you talked with Corey and Rami, right?
I did.
Yeah. At the convention that we had, mm-hmm. or conference that we had, the American Society of Architectural Illustrators.
Yes.
Which is a mouthful, so we usually call it ASAI.
Uh-huh.
Not to be confused with ASIA, which is Asia. But yeah, it happens to be a conference that's near and dear to me because the ASAI is something that I'm involved with, mm-hmm. as well. But Corey was president this year.
So the way I guess it works, Lon, is that every year whichever city is going to host it, there's a president in that city that represents it, right?
Yeah, and I learned this because we're hosting it next year.
Right.
I learned that it doesn't have to be in your city that you are in. It's just more convenient to be in proximity to where you live.
Right.
So we could have it in Hawaii, but it would be harder to plan if it was there.
But anyway, Corey did it this year, and so he's a member, obviously, of the ASAI.
Yeah, Tiltpixel is a member, and they've been a member for a while. It's a really great job that those guys did putting together, and honestly, it was under the most difficult of circumstances,
yeah.
considering that, you know, Houston, was still kind of reeling from the flood.
Yeah, from Hurricane Harvey. Yeah.
Which, by the way, I am incredibly impressed at how quickly that bounced back and recovered and so on. I know that there were areas that were harder hit than others, but generally the vibe, people were still upbeat. And
yeah,
I think the fact that the World Series was like, you know, they got into the World Series, yep. was another good thing. So we had a nice little competition because of the Houston versus LA standpoint.
But Tiltpixel is a really cool company, and I was the first time I met Corey, I guess, was at IMARC in Venice, right? He's just one of the most affable, friendly guys. Just fun to be around. Very positive, great attitude. And then I met Rami the next time I met him, which was in Vienna for D2. And he's also just a really sweet guy. I loved the fact that these guys started our company, you know, two of them out of their apartments for a while. And then eventually it's like, well, we're going to have to grow. And they end up getting this office. And they're a very, very, you know, good, reputable archivist company from Houston. So really, really like having them there.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I worked with Corey for a long time at Neoscape,
right?
For a bit, and then he moved back to Houston, and
yeah.
So we've known each other for a long time, been close friends, and it's good to catch up. And I think Rami, I actually met for the first time on a trip to Australia. We were both
what?
Yeah, we were both at the RTC like a Revit conference,
uh-huh.
and we were both over there. I think that was the first time that we met. And of course, Rami's heavily involved with Autodesk University, which we just came back
yes.
from, and he was there, you know, giving tour guides, you know, or giving tours and stuff. And
yeah, he's really cool. I like them, and the two of them they seem to really connect well and communicate with, you know, as a partners in a really cool way. So it was really awesome. All right. Well, we have a little bit of business to do. I am actually recording this podcast intro a little bit early because I'm about to go on Thanksgiving vacation.
You're about to go on a walkabout?
I'm going to go on a walkabout. Yeah, I'm taking the family to Death Valley, believe it or not. It sounds a little weird to go there for Thanksgiving, but it's just gorgeous place.
No, I think it's going to be amazing.
Yeah, gorgeous, gorgeous place.
Take all the lenses that you have.
Yeah, anything that it can refract light correctly.
Exactly.
I'm taking it with me. Okay, so what I've been trying to do is I've been trying to incentivize people to leave ratings and reviews for our podcast. And so mainly I'd like to see more on iTunes itself, and I know that it would be great to do that. I think I mentioned it on the last podcast. So if you guys are iTunes, listening to it on iTunes, or even if you're just listening it, just go ahead and go on iTunes and rate us and review us there, because it'd be great. I know a lot of you guys are listening in your car and you can't rate and review a podcast while you're driving, but try to remember when you get back to work or to home to give us a little review. It'd be really helpful.
Will Siri do it? Siri, please rate the CG Garage podcast at 5 stars, please.
That would be good.
I hope that works. I hope that,
we'll do it automatically for them.
Alexa.
Yep. But we did get a review, as I've been asking people to do, on our Facebook page, which is also cool. So if you guys want to know where that is, it's just facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast, all one word, CG Garage Podcast. And Michael Vargas left us a review, which is very nice of him. And I would, to incentivize you, I was going to start reading your reviews on the podcast intro. So here you go. He said, amazing podcast. Love to hear different people in their own field, and many things to learn. Really great. Thanks so much, Michael. I really appreciate that review. And if you guys leave a review, I will go ahead and read it.
Yeah,
give you a shout out.
We're only going to read the good ones, though. I mean, let's be honest.
No, I'll read the bad ones. It can be like what's Jimmy Kimmel's mean tweets?
mean tweets, like with tears and a drink.
Yeah, I did actually get, there was one review that said that I talked over to people too many times, which I've took to heart, and I don't do that as much. That was an old review from a while ago. All right. Well, thanks so much, guys. Hopefully you will appreciate this wonderful podcast from the guys at Tailpixel.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
So I realized, Corey, that you and I have never met until this year, and then suddenly we meet, like, a lot.
Yeah. Why is that?
I don't know.
All of a sudden, you guys are meeting.
In
all the time.
Venice. Vienna. And in
Houston.
Yeah.
Are you going to Autodesk University?
I don't know.
Maybe we'll meet up there.
Are you going to go to Autodesk University?
I will if you go.
But we didn't meet till D2, right?
We didn't meet till D2.
Right.
But then this is our second meeting probably within a couple months now. So
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but so, you were out of town when he came to our office.
I was out of town.
And we played Mario Kart and foosball.
I missed all that.
Yeah.
Flew a drone
a lot, yeah. That was fun.
You guys get to have all the fun.
Yeah, we did have fun. We did have fun.
That's good.
But okay, before we talk too much about, I want to talk about Tiltpixel and how you guys started that, but let's talk about the SAI a little bit.
Yeah.
Because we're here in Houston, my old hometown.
Your stomping ground.
My stomping ground is where I went to grad school. Yeah. A stone's throw from where I went to grad school. So tell people, because as you know, we have a lot of different people, tell people what the ASII is.
It's basically a nonprofit group.
Right.
And it's composed of architectural illustrators, both traditional medium and digital. Mm-hmm. So you've got watercolors, sketchers, even urban sketchers at times.
Right.
And then you've got the ArcViz guys, the mm-hmm. 3D guys, of architecture companies, of regular, like our business, Tiltpixel. We all get together and basically we're celebrating the art of architectural illustration. And
right.
Each year we have a competition, a rendering competition that we submit. Mm-hmm. And we select judges and we vet through all the renderings and we compose of a really good selected group of images that eventually get posted to an art exhibition during the conference. And then we have a big award ceremony.
Right.
And every year during the conference, we have, it's changed over the last couple of years of what the conference is. And I think over the next couple of years, it's going to change even a little bit more, get refined. But we bring in some of the best speakers to talk about actually a lot of different topics.
Okay.
Architecture, illustration, digital humans. Art history, which we just had with Jesus, and a little bit of art history there. And then, I mean, it could be a huge range of topics,
right?
But they all have, it's like they all share similarities in terms of storytelling, composition, lighting, and they all, I mean, we all have the same basic fundamentals,
right?
But we all have different variances of aspects of what we like to do. So,
yeah. And when was it founded?
Well, this is AIP 32, so 32 years ago.
32 years. Yeah. So it's been around for a long time.
For a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, so this, I guess one of the things that's cool about it is that it's kind of in a different city every year.
Every year, whoever the president is at the time.
Right. We'll host it.
We'll host it.
And so they swap presidents.
We swap presidents.
Every
year. And 1 year it was in Japan.
Really?
So it's international. It's not just, we say American.
Right.
But it's international. So. Right.
But it's, yeah. What's unique about it is it's one event that really combines, you know, the old school illustration along with 3D artists that don't even think of themselves as illustrators. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, this light bulb goes off where it's like, oh, wait a minute, I do 3D art, but I'm really an illustrator in some ways, you know, and a lot of people don't recognize that. And so I think it's one event that kind of celebrates both of the mediums.
The artistry of it all.
Right.
Right.
Which is unique.
What I think is interesting is that long tradition, right, of architectural mm-hmm. illustration. And that tradition was continued in the computer graphics world. It was natural that computer graphics would gravitate towards it. But the thing that I was, you know, trying to stress is that because of this long history of architectural visualization or architectural illustration, there are lots of rules that have happened along the way about understanding a composition and color mm-hmm. and lighting and story and all those things. And those things are very important. So having an organization that preserves some of that tradition is important for those, even if they do go into the computer graphics area, they need to look back to those masters and think about what's important about it, right?
Yeah,
the fundamentals.
That's the presentation I'm giving in the next couple hours is about, you know, the fundamentals of, you know, composition and staging and set dressing. And a lot of it's, you know, looking back at the masters, like you said, like Julius Shulman and Ezra mm-hmm. Stoller, and, you know, because we can learn a lot of things. We can save a lot of time, you know, learning from what's right. already been done in the past and what was successful and using those in our work. And it's made my work better. And I kind of wish someone had taught me that before, you know, save a lot of time. But yeah, I think looking at those illustrations, you know, how do you do a projection drawing, you know, in perspective, and how do you do shadows correctly, and how do you draw that? Understanding, you know, how do shadows work from this angle and drawing it out, and understanding that, you know, the math behind, or the, at least the lines behind it, is very helpful for understanding the way we illustrate and visually see things, I think.
Right. Right. So this year it's in Houston. Next year it's going to be in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Right?
Lon Groves will be the president.
And how do people get more information about ASAI? I guess there's the website, ASAI.org, right?
Yeah, ASAI.org. And I think we're in the process of developing maybe three separate sites.
Okay.
ASAI.org as like the base level.
Right.
Go to for information about what it is, who we are. And then we're looking at starting a, you know, conference site and possibly a site for the competition. Because they're all three, you know, the conference and the competition are both their own entities, mm-hmm. but they funnel into ASAI. I mean,
I got it.
And so it would be, it's something we're discussing that we haven't implemented yet, but I think it makes sense. So okay. people can quickly go to the conference. So for next year, Architecture and Perspective 33.
Right.
You can go to the conference page and then get a list of who the speakers are.
Right.
Get a list of the times, get a list of locations, hotels, nearby, you know, events or mm-hmm. or places to visit. I think that makes the most sense to okay. break it up that way. And then just have the ASAI.org be the base site that you can go to for all the information of who we are and what we are, and also who the members are. And because a lot of members have gotten work out of that.
You know? Right.
So if you're looking for an illustrator, you can go log into ASAI.org and basically you have a pick of over 200 people that you can vet through, mm-hmm. and you can look at for watercolors, you can look for sketchers, you can look for big rendering companies. I mean, and they have portfolios there too that you could see their work, and then their contact information.
Well, that's great. That's a really good resource for people to have. And the prize is actually significant. I mean, the SAI prize is not like, here's a nice little statue, right?
No, you get a medallion.
Uh-huh.
For the Hugh Ferris, it's the Hugh Ferris Award.
Right.
So it's actually a $5,000 prize.
It's so a significant award.
Yeah, it's not insignificant by any means. And
right.
And it also comes with a very nice framed picture with this beautiful medallion, this mm-hmm. Hugh Ferris medallion that is made. And it's a big deal.
And it's fairly prestigious because the jury process or the vetting process is pretty extensive. Mm-hmm. And there are, I don't know how many submissions. I think you guys went through hundreds and hundreds of renderings and images. So, and it's a whole day process.
It was about 10 hours at our office.
Right.
Straight. Now it's just for the professional category. We have three different categories. We have the professional category, the observational category, which is drawing something that you see in real life.
Yeah.
Observational.
Right.
And a student category. Mm-hmm. And even the student top winner, I think, receives a monetary award.
Right.
I'd have to go back and look at the actual breakdown of what it is, but
okay.
Yeah, it's a very prestigious award that, you know, people clamor to get to, and it's really difficult. There's only been a handful, I think, of dual winners.
Right.
So you're really a master if you can get it twice.
Right.
But there are people who have been trying for years that, you know, it's just
right.
It's difficult.
Right. And this year was kind of interesting because it was a non-CG one. It hasn't been one for a long time that won the Hugh Ferris, right?
Right. And the thought here was, you know, with photorealism and animations and computer graphics, that there's such beautiful renderings being produced that no way will traditional watercolors or sketch win anymore.
Right.
But that is not the case. I mean, I would say, you know, I was in the jury. I wasn't a judge, but I was helping mm-hmm. facilitate the jurors. And I would say as soon as that image came up, it just struck with all three of them. So yeah, it's a beautiful rendering.
Yeah. And it's watercolor,
Watercolor. Yeah.
So it's interesting. Now, how long have you guys been in the, you guys are both members of the SAI, right?
Yeah.
And how long have you guys been members?
As a company or individuals?
I would say two or three years.
A couple years. Okay. So that your company is sort of very present here, obviously, because of it's in Houston and you guys are hosting it and you're bringing like all the people from your office are coming here, right?
Yeah. We brought everybody.
So yeah, they represented. So, you know, we brought a lot of them to, and a lot of it too is, you know, it's new for them to experience, you know, events too.
Right.
So it was, yeah, it was interesting.
Well, how long have you guys, when did you guys start Tilpixel?
You know, we have this discussion all the time. Like, when was the LLC officially formed? I would just, the way I like to say it is, you know, I was out on my own at the end of 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And those were dark times. I mean,
everyone was scraping for work.
Yeah, scraping.
Right. And it's after 2008, right?
Yes.
So I always say to people, like, one of the hardest hit areas is architecture, because the first thing you do when the economy is bad is you stop building.
Right.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Everyone will be fine if they just stop building. So that means architects are out of work. Right.
Yeah.
So
which trickles down to
you guys,
all the vendors.
And at the time I was at an architecture firm and we went from maybe 120 people down to maybe 60, like we cut 50% of the workforce.
Wow.
And somehow I got through all that. And they, so, you know, it was something they were trying to say, but, somewhere in that time, then, you know, we met up. So,
right.
So what's interesting about, I would say our ended up, well, okay. It's a funny story. So we both went to Texas A&M.
Okay.
We both went to the same school.
Same school. And so all Aggies, that's what we're called. We have the same class ring.
Right.
I mean, the only difference is the
I know
year.
About the ring.
Yeah.
Well, I'm trying magical to explain ring. It for okay. the Aggie
yeah.
network.
That tells it. Yeah. So you have a class
it's
ring.
It's audio. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you see it?
Yeah. So the thing is about an Aggie ring is you can see it from a distance.
Yes. It's like a beacon.
Yeah. So it's an instant conversation piece. Well, I was manning a booth in 2008.
Yeah. Manning a booth?
Yeah. Okay. I think it was a Viz conference in Boston.
It was a DMVC conference. That's what it was. CG Architect used to put on.
Oh, right.
And back in 2008.
I was Manning a booth when
Corey was up in Boston. And it happened to be up there.
Right. You were at Neoscape.
And I was a young, starry-eyed 3D artist, and I wanted to learn. And so I went up and just checked the whole thing out. And then
he saw my ring. He's like, oh, you're an Aggie. And I said, yeah. I said, are you an Aggie? He's like, yeah. So then we instantly started talking.
Right.
So we talked shop for a little bit and then parted ways because he had to leave. He had a flight back that night, and I never talked to him again.
Okay.
And then after 09, the end of 09, I was back in Houston, and I was kind of scrapping, pulling up my bootstraps and scrapping through, getting any rendering I could get, banging it out as a lone wolf. And I got a great opportunity to do some really great renderings with Exxon for the ExxonMobil headquarters.
Oh, right.
And I was doing an animation with one computer, and I was trying to figure out, can I do a velocity pass without rendering it in so I could just save time?
Mm-hmm.
So Rami used to be a really well-known blogger, and I stumbled upon his website, and he had something about velocity pass.
Right.
And I noticed, oh, he's in Houston. I'm in Houston.
Right.
But I didn't remember that I had met him.
Mm-hmm.
So I emailed him. I said, hey, just want to talk shop. I see you're in Houston. I'm by myself. Just, it'd be great to meet up and just, talk tutorials, what are you working on kind of stuff. And
right.
So I sent off this email.
So I got the email and I sat on the email for maybe a couple of weeks.
Really?
At first I was like, who is this guy? I didn't know who it was. And then finally clicked. I was like, that's the guy I met in Boston who was also an Aggie. So
right.
Eventually I got around to emailing him and I was like, it was nice to meet you. And so I think we connected through email initially.
And then I remembered that I had met him and then it all clicked. Right. So then I just said, hey, let's have lunch. And to make fast forward this story a little bit, we had several lunches.
Uh-huh.
And I started, getting more work and I said, I think I'm gonna register a name to make a company.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what do you think about maybe leaving your cushy 8-year secure job that you have right. after just having twins
right.
and taking a risk and joining up with me.
Yeah. So I was at an architecture firm and they just made me an associate. I just had twins. Right. It was a comfortable job. Why would I leave? Right.
Right.
And so he proposes this proposition.
It's a crazy idea.
I'm thinking about it. So I didn't make a decision. I don't think.
It took a year.
It took at least half a year for me to at least think about it, and be like, right. take it seriously.
Yeah.
Because if you know my personality, I'm very cautious, very safe, and very, make sure things were
and
working.
And I'm the other side of that yin and yang.
Right.
You're
like, let's try it.
I'm more
let's
of a it. Calculated risk taker. Yeah.
Right.
But eventually, I registered the name and started the LLC. And not too long after that, you started up with me.
I joined you.
Yeah. So it's 2009, 2010?
No, I would say it's closer to 2011. 2011.
Is
when we finally...
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe towards the end of 11. Yeah. But prior from that, I was working by myself. But
okay.
From that point on, we worked out of our houses for a while. And then we just realized we needed to bring all these render machines that we were hacking together
right.
to one location.
But he would work on his computer at home, and I work on my computer at home. We would just communicate through Google Talk at
right.
the time. And it was... we'd be up at hours of the night and rendering on our machines, and the rooms would get hot, and we'd trip our circuit breakers.
I had extension cords all throughout my house because I was blowing fuses left and right because I was trying to stack more and more computers together.
So we finally got to the point where we're like, we have to get an office.
Yeah, we got to get an office. So. Our wives are going to divorce us.
Right. How long did you guys operate out of your house?
It was about a year. Well, he'd done it longer, but I had done it. Together, we had done about a year and a half.
And were you guys doing mostly stills, or were you doing animations?
We actually, I think I did an animation at one point. It was on one workstation and a laptop. And we got it out.
Yeah.
It was, but...
Mostly stills, though.
How did you get work in those days? Like, what was your process of finding...
Well, I was, like I said, I was lucky. I don't know. I had finished the ExxonMobil project.
You had finished that.
Yeah, but that had allowed me to get a really good portfolio under my wing,
Right.
And from there, it really just was keeping in contact with people I knew and just reaching out and saying, hey, just checking in, seeing how you're doing. Right. And it was a lot of cold calling in a way, or cold emailing, and just following up with contacts. And it slowly started to build up.
And for me, while I was still at the architecture firm, I'd done some moonlighting with, you know, some developers. And so I had one contact who worked for a developer, and then he, you know, developers talk. And so he talked to another guy. And so I had these two clients. Mm-hmm. And still to this day, actually, a lot of the work we're doing is for that developer, and they turned out to be a large developer.
But yeah, it kind of snowballed from there, and then it was a lot of word of mouth.
Mostly word of mouth.
We didn't. I mean, when it was just two of us, we didn't really have the funds to do a lot of marketing efforts, and you know, so it was.
I remember though the first 2 weeks that I quit, I really didn't have anything to do. My wife is freaking out. I was sitting there playing Xbox, and she's like, "What are you doing? You know, you just quit your job." And I think since then, those are the only 2 weeks that I had nothing to do, and that was how many years ago now? So,
right.
At least five, six.
It's interesting because, you know, a lot of people are like, you know, as an artist, as an example, they always have to try to advertise themselves, whatever. So they'll go to like ArtStation or CG Society or whatever and try to do that. But you guys sort of needed to find your customers in a very different way, more word of mouth. And I think that's kind of an interesting proposition. I also think that what's interesting is that you guys are going after directly the developers, which is not uncommon for the ArcFizz community, but it's not necessarily known that people don't always work for an architect or an interior designer. They work for a developer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for me, coming from an architecture firm, I knew that, you know, the architects, you know, don't really have the budget to do the renderings that they needed to do. And in fact, as an in-house artist doing renderings for architects, they would never charge for them. And so I think even architects had a difficulty finding the value, you know, in the imagery that they're producing, even though, you know, it's at one point it's going to be for documentation, how to profit off of that. And so I think, you know,
yeah, but the developers still need the images to sell.
Eventually it's going into the developer.
They need to sell the property. Right. So they need the renderings, and that's going to be a better work for them. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, your client has another client. So when you can figure out, you know, who is that end client, like the end client, if you can work directly with that, it takes a lot of people out of the process, and make it more profitable, make the process easier, really.
Right.
Yeah, because the end client may want something, you know, what one image, whereas all the middlemen change it up,
right,
to make it so that the end client can see it. But the end client's like, oh, I really just wanted this.
Yeah.
And why did we go through all that to?
Yeah, I really just wanted a pretty picture. I don't care about the mullions, you know.
It's easy to work direct with the person in charge, because at the end of the day, if you go back and somebody wants you to do something that you're just like, well, I mean, he's my end client,
right?
You know, and so we're going to make sure we do what he wants.
But it's interesting. Do you find, for example, like you said, the developer says, I just want the image of the building to sell my property, and I don't care about the door handles, or I don't care about the mullions or whatever, right? And so you guys make those decisions,
right?
Essentially.
Yeah.
Does that ever come back? Does the architect said, well, this door handle doesn't look like correct because in the rendering it was like this or whatever?
It does sometimes. It depends on where in the hierarchy the architect is in the process with the client. You know, if your end client is an owner of the property or developer, and he doesn't really care about, you know, those details, he just wants a marketing image to sell to the city to get, you know, to buy in or something like that. You can go around the architect. Of course, if, you know, it depends on their perception of the architect. It also depends on how far in the process the project is. And so if they want to get things accurate, sometimes it'll come back and they'll want to see what some of the design elements look like on the building. And
but I think some of the best projects are when I do a lot of interiors.
Right.
So, I mean, that's my background. So when I get a client that says, oh, I don't have a designer involved, but I want an interior, say it's residential and it's like a, you know, an amenity space, a club lounge space. And they're like, just, you know, give me a couple of reference images and then I'll design something. Mm-hmm. And then those to me are some of the best projects, best images that come out.
Actually, those are the ones that win awards for us.
Yeah.
The ones that we designed. That
we had one client. It was this little penthouse. I mean, not very big space at all on top of a commercial building. Mm-hmm. And the brokers were like, I think they were the brokers at the time. Well, they were like, we want to develop this space, but So they gave me, we want to make it Zen-like, make it like a yoga studio. So I banged that out and they're like, eh, I don't, maybe yoga's not right. And so in the middle of the night, I get this one liner and it's like, make it look like a hipster private club, Mad Men bar with exposed brick. And I was like,
what?
What?
What do you do with that?
So I spent the next day or that night
Designing it,
banging it out. I put like leather sofas in, and I tell you what, that is one of the images that went out, and never changed after that. It was right. Approved that day, and that image still has legs. It pops up on Pinterest all the time.
Oh, really?
I see it all over the internet.
Blogs on. I mean, it is one of the craziest.
It's weird because I'll wake up and I'll see you know it'll pop up on my Google search or whatever, and yeah. It's like, oh, that's our image from years ago.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's strange how some images do that, though.
Actually, I think that was one that we won the ASAI award for.
We did.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Several years ago.
A couple years ago.
2 years ago.
2 years ago.
Oh, wow.
So those are the best projects, though. I love those the most.
Well, yeah, right? Because you're composing it specifically with, you can compose it with a lot more freedom, right? Like you've got an idea. And the other thing, right? This is the other thing, right? The guy was telling, this goes back to what we were telling before. He was telling you a story and you had to illustrate that story.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. Right.
It was like yoga studio. Okay. That's not that much detail.
not a lot of information.
Hipster madman bar, blah, blah, blah. It's like, okay, wait a minute. Hold on. You're trying to imagine this whole thing. And then as you're imagining it, you're putting it together.
Yeah. Your imagination starts running with ideas of what could that look like. And you get excited about something that you've never seen before. And so...
Plus, I got to pick the camera. I got to be the storyteller and the artist and the designer. And, you know, clients will pick cameras that aren't the most desirable, even if you try and talk them out of it. And even if you show them the best one point that just really blows up that image and makes it look great, sometimes they'll change their mind and say, no, I want it from this corner at like 12 millimeter. And you're just like, what are you doing?
Right.
Why? So...
Yeah, there are challenges that we have to work with. You know, at the end of the day, there are clients, but sometimes, you know, we'll do an image and we're really happy with it, and then it'll come back with some comments, and as artists, we feel like, you know, it's going to pull it back. So we know that at the end of the day, you know, there's one that, you know, this is what pays the bills.
Right.
So we'll say, you know, this one's for you, and then this one's for us, and we'll put this is our portfolio piece. And
Right. I mean, we're the experts. We try, you know, we try and tell them the best solution for their problem, but... Like Rami said, at the end of the day, they're paying for what they want. And so we give them what they want. But we'll keep a side image for marketing.
That happened, you know, that even happened when I was in visual effects. There is a lot of times where you're working on a shot and it looks great. And then the client says, the director, whoever, like, I want it like this. And it's like, ugh. And it starts looking that great. And it's like, I love it. So he's like, we always say, it's like, well, you'll keep the old comp for your demo reel.
Right.
And then the rest of the other one, you can do that. But it is a kind of a problem because your old comp was not what was in the movie. And so it's a little bit harder to show that. But at the same time, I think you're right. Like, you can keep that out of rendering for yourselves, right? That's no problem.
Yeah. And that's what we market. And so we know, you know, if we want clients that have a certain appeal for a certain image, that's what we'll post and say, and they'll see that and say, okay, they produce images like this. That's what I want. Mm-hmm. So it kind of circular where they come to us saying, you know, do the images that you guys are excited about. So
right.
Rather than posting the ones that got tweaked or we're not excited about. So yeah.
What is your process? So obviously now your guys aren't just two guys that are working out of your house. You have an office, right? You've got about 10 people, maybe?
No? 11.
We have 11 now.
11,
That's pretty great. And like I said, I was hanging out at your office, so it was a really cool space. A lot of Legos stuff going on.
A lot of Legos. Lego conference table.
A Lego conference table, et cetera. You guys have, you know, some good space to grow as well. It's looking like it.
We have room to grow.
Yeah. And you guys are getting the same customers or same customers, or is it just growing and growing from this point? You have enough to have 11
people. We have a lot of the same consistent customers that, you know, we've had some longstanding relationships with some clients that keep coming back. But we always get, you know, cold calls and, you know, from clients that I have no idea where they've heard from us. And that's always a question. It's like, where did you hear about us? And they would say, oh, so-and-so said this and this. So a lot of it's still word of mouth.
Right.
But it's,
But we're making a shift.
It's adjusting a little bit as we grow. I think we're trying to be a little more, as we're growing, we're trying to be a little more strategic.
Okay.
With, you know, who we're selling to and who we're providing work for.
Right.
And I think we can be a little more selective with kind of what are the kind of works that we want to do.
Well, that's nice to be in that position.
Well, yeah, to some degree. I mean, we're when you go from two people to five people, there's a different way of thinking.
Yeah.
And then from five people to 10 people and 11 people, you got to actually start looking at things that you didn't even really have to look at when you were two or three people. So, you know, this summer, we had a offsite meeting where we went through everything. Branding, how we're positioning ourselves, marketing, because we haven't really been doing any marketing. So, you know, how do we get out there?
How are you approaching marketing now?
We're still in that phase of development.
Well, that's an important question, because it's an interesting thing, you know, because I was just thinking about, you're not dissimilar from Vlado and Peter, right, at Chaos Group. Vlado and Peter started V-Ray and out of a Delphi forum, right? Mm-hmm. They weren't marketing anything.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah.
So the entire brand of V-Ray was word of mouth and it's exploded.
Yeah.
The website even at the time was terrible. You know, fans, it was not very good. Now it's a really nice website. But it was the idea of branding yourself is an interesting one, right? Like how do you brand yourself or what makes you different? And there must have been a lot that has changed in terms of what you think of your, back when it was just you and Rami and, you know, sort of working out of your house, it was like, got some renderings to do. Here's a project, here's the rendering. It's got to be different now. You got to be doing a lot more different things at this point.
Oh yeah.
We are. I mean, I never even would have thought that we'd get into, you know, real time and VR. And obviously technology has changed as well. But yeah, I mean, there's some projects that I never would have thought about. Whereas before it was just like, oh, here's a rendering of, you know, a bedroom or a house or a, and you know, to do a VR tour of, you know, a full scale building that's under construction in downtown Houston, or do helicopter shoots and camera track and match with, you know, visual effects software for architecture. It's really, you know, it's neat to get into those different practices and learn lots of new things. And so it's, at the same time too, I think there's lots of stuff where we have to learn, you know, there needs to be R&D going on because the technology is changing and we're always trying to find a new way to solve an old problem. It's, it seems like there's a lot of new stuff on the horizon for us.
Yeah. We purchased some tech and some new stuff out there that just to do some R&D and test it out and see if we can even use it efficiently, like 360 cameras, right? And if VR is such a big thing, you know, then you're going to need cameras to shoot this stuff.
Right.
And we just bought a camera. We've got so busy trying to organize the ASAI conference and then also keep, you know, working on all the projects that we barely even opened the camera, but it's been sitting there. And every time I pass by, it breaks my heart. Cause I'm just like, I just want to break this open, shoot some video. Cause it's like 8K footage.
Right.
And look at it on the headset.
It's a camera that shoots 8K 360 video. So
that's pretty good.
Yeah.
So that is a problem with the 360 cameras, that they are soft because they're
so low. And really when you're in the 360 space, you're not really looking at 4K. You're looking at maybe, you know, a quarter of that, if that. So resolution is a factor, I think.
But I made it my resolution after this conference. I'm going to break that open and I'm going to do some amazing
R&D Well, the stuff. Other thing that you guys have, which I think is also really interesting in the architecture world, is a drone.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So what I've been, you know, discovering is people like buy drones, right? And they're like, I don't know what I'm going to do with this drone. Or people buy a VR headset. It's like, I don't know what I'm going to do. But at architecture, this is new technology that's like everyone's talking about. It just fits right into the architecture world.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So like I've been preaching about the whole VR thing and architecture for a while. But the drone itself is another thing that's interesting because it used to be, you were saying, is you had to get up in a helicopter, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's
a
lot more expensive.
It's a lot more expensive. It's also more dangerous.
More dangerous. You can't really get close to things.
Right. But it takes longer, right? Too. I mean, the whole process of getting the equipment and the camera and
But the problem is the city starts to shut down drones. I mean, I don't know. They have such a fear of drones these days. But it's like, oh, this is a no drone zone, or this. You have to get registered and pay fees, and it's like, yeah, it's just a little drone. It's not going up to where the planes are, you know?
Right.
But it is safer than helicopters. I went on a helicopter shoot once with a, I think he was a crazy like Air Force pilot or something. Because he's like, yeah, most pilots won't fly through downtown Houston because of all the crosswinds. But yeah, I got this. And we just went right up over the Pennzoil building. And I basically could have almost reached down and touched it. And
oh, my God.
I didn't have a door on my side either. So I was just buckled in.
It was you in the ground below.
And I'm not that big of a fan of flying. So took me out of my comfort zone a little bit, faced my fears. But I was happy to be back on the ground after that.
Wow.
Yeah. So a drone would have been a little bit easier to handle.
And now that's, you know, a lot of the drones, you know, you can get, you know, a lot of them you see are four props, but you can get six prop and eight props, and the payloads on them can get much bigger. So you can actually get an SLR camera on them. So we've gotten actually some significant footage from a drone. And we use it on a project in Austin. And it looks great. I mean, it was 4K and it was high res. And
but what's that brand? I'm not blanking. It's like three letters or something.
DJI.
Yes.
Yeah.
That drone technology. Those guys are killing it.
Yeah.
Because that drone is completely like, you can just say, just go there and come back.
Right.
And it'll do it.
And you saw it, and it was just hovering by itself.
Yours is, the old Phantom ones, right?
Yeah.
But they have
the
new ones now that are like insanely.
They're getting very easy to use.
The one you can hold is designed for an indoor selfie drone.
Oh, is it that little?
It's a teeny little one.
It's a small one.
Is it gray? And you just throw it.
You can throw it
and it'll just, and it's like, take a picture, and it'll take a picture of you and then come back.
They're getting so easy to use.
Yeah.
And
they're not as expensive, right?
No, the price point for them is much. I mean, you can go to Best Buy and it's very consumer competitive.
Like one of the ones I have, which is like, would be more than enough to do, is like $1,000.
Yeah.
It's not that bad considering you can use it for very high quality footage. Right?
Yeah. Considering you buy 4K. A TV, you know, across the aisle
and it
for the same
4K.
Price.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
yeah,
it's definitely more available for just regular consumers.
So that gives you guys another tool for your arsenal, but it also gives you a bunch of new technology that you need to learn, right?
Right.
Yeah. Now you got to track.
There's tracking. And we've found a process that works for us that's pretty flawless for aerials. It works pretty well.
What do you use?
Bougie.
We're using Bougie.
Yeah.
And
it's easy.
It's, you know, it does one thing, but it does it really well.
Sure.
And so
PF Track's the other choice.
Yeah. I mean, and so, you know, you could obviously do it in Nuke or After Effects, but we found something that's just, for me, the first time I used it, it worked. And I thought, this is almost magical, right? Mm-hmm. So it works. And
We're not tracking like, the visual effects artists are tracking all their crazy stuff. Ours is pretty simple. We just drop in a building.
You got to make sure the building sticks to the ground.
Once it sticks, though, we can put anything in it, and it's really nice.
Yeah. And you don't have to. But then now also you're doing things like roto.
Yeah. And then the hard part is making sure that your 3D is, you know, on, you know, if you have topo and the ground is different heights and things.
Right.
And so there are some challenges around. You know, what do we do with that car that, you know, clips off the video footage mm-hmm. or behind the rendering? And so there are ways we have to fake a lot of the stuff that, you know, in the end, you know, it'll work when you're doing a sequence of images and it goes quickly. But yeah, it's a new fun challenge too. So we've done a couple of those.
Yeah. What you really got to figure out is how to take your 360 camera and attach it to your drone.
Now you're talking. Although that may make people nauseous.
We actually did.
That's the thing you need to learn, right?
Right.
This is another thing. Okay, is there a speed that you can do a drone at with your 360 camera, right? Because I think a lot of people think that you can't do motion in VR, and that's not necessarily.
It's not necessarily.
You can, but I think we did a tour previously, and I think we figured out what the key was. You will need. Like the sweet spot is that there are moving elements in the video footage, but the camera is not necessarily flying through like you think a traditional fly through.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think just enough movement where you see, you know,
where it feels
birds
real,
flying realism. And planes in the air and the clouds moving and waterfalls. And And when you get that movement and the sound, it's very immersive, and you're in the space like you're actually there. Mm-hmm. Because in reality, you're not, you know, you're not on a bicycle riding through the city. You're kind of standing in one spot and absorbing what's around you.
But so, I think what we are doing is just a small blip, because it's going to change.
It is.
I mean, with Unreal and Unity, you know, making strides, it's all going to be a quick transition from what we just did over to more real time. Mm-hmm. But I think we're going to have to figure out the speed at which people can move through without wanting to just hurl. I mean,
right.
I'm pretty, you know, knowledgeable in VR, and I've done some tours at, you know, conferences where I just put on the headset and I barely walk around, and I'm an avid gamer too.
I know.
And I take like 45 minutes.
Not just for the rest of the day.
Yeah. 45 minutes to recover. So, when we get an actual paid client, we,
right,
at least in this time frame, we suggest keeping the camera still, but having activity and movement and things.
So that is a safe way to go. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But for example, I have a friend of mine, his name is Kevin Mack, and he's an artist, and he used to be in visual effects, but he now does VR art, like conceptual VR art, right?
Oh, that'd be cool.
And you fly around this thing in VR, and a lot, and you have control over your flying. And I'm very sensitive, right? It's probably one of the reasons I get upset about VR, but but I was not sick at all. And I said, how did you do this? Like, what did you do? Is there a certain speed you do? Whatever. He goes, it's actually way simpler than that. I give all rotation, not one degree of freedom, to the artist, to the person, the user.
Yeah.
And then the translation, you know, we'll take it. So the way you do it is you have your two grips or whatever.
Right.
And then you pull the trigger. And wherever your hand's pointing is where you're going to go. But then you can look around like anything else and go, all right, I'm going to go here. Like, oh. But you have complete freedom of where you're looking always.
Hmm.
And so the translation happens, you know, virtually.
Yeah.
But the rotation happens. And so it's a matter of like, so if you were to use his theory, let's say you had a drone, right? And you put your 360 camera on it.
Mm-hmm.
If you attached it to the bottom of it and your drone only went, never rotated at all.
Right.
Just went straight up, down. It could translate side to side,
right,
but never rotate in any way,
right,
and stayed stable, which it does by design. Technically, you'd be fine.
You'd be okay.
Technically. According to his theory, but it would be an interesting thing to try.
It is an interesting theory, because I've seen videos in jet planes, and it, you know, you'll see those videos where it's a pretty straight path, and you think this is a cool video, and then you see others where it's information overload.
Right.
So there may be something to that.
The translation is your the translation is something you have way more tolerance for. Rotation is really important,
right?
Because that's what our heads do. So yeah,
that's what our balance is, right? So
yeah,
that's what we're doing,
moving in one direction while looking in another direction.
The other challenge for us is also with, you know, something so immersive, how do you control the story, you know, in a 360 space? And you hear lots of things about, you know, we do stereo sound where, you know, the sound is on the right or the left, mm-hmm, to get the viewer to turn so they can see that, you know, that thing that's popping up. Or mm-hmm, we did an animation in 360, and it's,
yeah, we did a build on animation,
and it's tricky because it's like, you know, we want to tell the client, oh, quick, turn around, this is the cool part, you know, and
right,
if they're not looking in the right direction, they could miss it.
But so I had the impression where, because we had literally, you were standing on a blank slab and the building built on around you,
mm-hmm,
that even if you were only looking in one direction, you're going to want to watch it several more times. So you can look in the other direction. You can,
right,
look at the other direction.
Right.
You can look up, you can look down. And so they're constantly watching it more than one, two, three times.
And you always get a different experience watching the same video footage,
now,
which is really cool.
If there was something that I needed them to see at that exact moment, then we would try and incorporate like a sound to draw your attention to it or something of that nature. But I was happy that they wanted to watch it over and over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, instead of just playing an animation once, getting that a 2D image that's moving, and then they're done.
Right.
This was immersive. This built around you. And the project was such at a large scale. I think it had 30-foot ceilings or 40-foot ceilings. I don't even know.
Yeah, it was
depending
huge.
On the, it was big. It was multiple levels. So mm-hmm. you felt like you were in that space because it was so big and so expansive.
Wow.
And building on around you was just it was just.
So how did you guys do that project? Was it set up for a Gear VR or something like that?
Well, initially we set it up for two ways on the Oculus.
Mm-hmm.
And on
initially the goal was the Oculus,
but yeah. It was a 360 video.
It was a 360 video. Okay. It was a 360 video tour.
360 tour. Video tour.
Was it in stereo or not in stereo?
No,
this one was not in stereo.
Okay.
Yeah. And we
basically had about 2 weeks to get this done.
Yeah. Okay.
And yeah. Rami's brother is a great coder. And so he just went into the program, which one?
He basically took KR Pano because it's open source.
Oh, yeah.
He
made a KR Pano version.
Right. I mean, the bones of it yep. is KR Pano, but we mm-hmm. tweaked it to do what we needed to do.
But our goal was to do 360 videos that would tour. So when you went to a new hotspot, it started playing that video to a new hotspot, played that video. So you got all the action, the movement, the activity.
Yeah.
Instead of going still to still to still.
Mm-hmm.
It worked great on the Oculus because it's a computer. We had an issue with mobile because every time you went from a hotspot,
it's very specific.
It wants you to hit play on your phone. Well, you can't do that if you're staring at it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then so the remote wouldn't work either.
It's mobile VR video, which was, it's a very specific scenario where there's still some technology limitations,
but
there are solutions.
Give your brother a shout out.
So yeah, my brother is Michael Hanna.
He has
a website, Insight Coder, if you need anyone.
Insight Coder?
Insight Coder.
Nice. So free little freelance coding guy.
Okay. There you go. But the thing is that what he figured out was if it understood if you were on an Oculus or if you were on a mobile. And if it was on a mobile, mm-hmm. it immediately, we made two different versions. One that had movies.
Mm-hmm.
The other one was stills.
Okay.
And so it knew it would automatic. If you were on a mobile, it would just jump to the stills version that we didn't, it didn't get lost in translation.
And we also had different resolution versions. So if, a computer got too slow, we had a 2K, a 3K and a 4K, version. So on the fly,
So what was this project for?
So it was for Capitol Tower. That's under construction
in Houston.
Houston.
Okay. Is it available on the web?
It's online.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's the developer is Skanska. So we worked with Skanska on that.
I think it's on our blog.
There's a link of it on our blog, on our website. And if you go to our blog on tiltpixel.com, you'll find it on there, but it is kind of fun because it's immersive. It's a tour and it's a video. And we also did some green screen with it as well. So that was some new, to throwing green screen into a 360 was kind of a new thing. So
we went and bought a green screen, bought lights. I mean, we had 2 weeks to get this done. Mm-hmm. And so, we threw a lot at it in a 2 week period and learned a lot. So
it was
now
pretty ambitious for us.
It was very ambitious. Yeah. But now we could go back from what we learned. We can clean it up. The roto could be a little bit tighter. Everything could be a little more crisp down the road.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you what, it was highly successful.
Right.
That project. And
do you guys feel that you guys are obviously doing VR work, but do you guys feel like you're doing more and more and more these days?
We are, and it's kind of an add-on with the renderings we do. And so a lot of times we'll have clients say, oh, we need a list of this renderings. Oh, and by the way, we're going to do a VR tour.
Right.
And so it's just kind of like, they throw it on like, we need to do this as well. And
it's funny because I think it's going to be the other way around at some point.
I think
they're going to start saying we need a whole VR tour and maybe we'll get some renderings too while we're at it as a bonus.
Yeah, and it would make more sense because when we're doing the renderings in the back of our minds, we're thinking 360. So it's like, all right, we also have to model, the chair back here that you can't see and everything. So
what they'll do is, like you said, they'll want the VR tours and then they'll say, oh, can you just throw me a couple of those stills too? I know they're all skewed on the sides, but I'll just crop in the middle.
Yeah.
It's great though. I like VR a lot.
It is. And we're doing a lot more renderings, just 360s. And I think we're getting more used to just looking at them and understanding what they are.
It's interesting. Okay. Because I was speaking to the guys over at Steel Blue and they feel that they're doing 360 stills a lot too. They're not even doing stereo because, the stereo versions of the stills are really good and significant, but because it's only 3 degrees of freedom using the Gear VR, that makes them a little bit more nauseous.
Interesting.
So when they go to straight 360 images, it's like more forgiving in terms of not having translation in there somehow.
Yeah, because it's really, you're used to looking at a flat image on a maybe computer screen.
Right.
And you're not getting the, you know, the right left eye thing.
But when you do have proper stereo, you guys have done, you guys obviously done stereo.
We have.
We've done it.
Yes. Yeah, it's significantly different.
It is, because you really do see the scale significantly.
And we did some tests, mono and stereo, and it was like, wow, it feels very different.
It is
like,
different, but it was interesting to think about the idea of the nausea problem, right? So that's a real... It's a big thing, because you guys are actually making some free like VR stuff that's being seen by people that are actually not even gamers, mostly. You know, they're like,
right.
You have top executives coming in who aren't even used to VR.
Who've never played a
video
game.
That's why I would never even risk going in a route in a direction that way that could even make them nauseous at that point. Pushing the envelopes on other things is fine, but when you have an end deliverable
and some of them are apprehensive to even just put the headset on.
Play safe, yeah.
So that's a factor, and you know, I'm sure that someone will figure it out, and maybe one day they'll be like glasses and they'll be purely augmented reality somehow.
But, right.
So it's and I think that's going to be the future, in my opinion, because then it's more collaborative and you can say, hey, look at this, and you know, when you have a headset on, you're kind of by yourself and you're kind of exposed and you know,
I'm going to show you something called visual vocals after this, because you guys should check it out. Because that is what you just brought up is very important. There is VR doesn't just have a, you know, adaptivity or people adapting it or going for it. They also have a communication problem, specifically when you're dealing with architecture. One person has the headset and is in the experience, and no one else knows what that person's doing.
Right.
And so you can't really think of it that way. So so I think there's a communication problem that's happening in VR. And Visual Vocals is interested in solving that problem. So it's a very interesting thing. So I'll show you guys what you think. But I don't disagree that AR is also a really good a thing that's going to happen, right?
Yes, and I think, you know, the technology obviously is more sophisticated,
right?
And so it's not as easily accessible, or people aren't doing it as much, but it's obviously there. I think it's going to come. It's going to be easier to do at some point, somewhere down the line, I think.
Yeah. Absolutely. So we're actually pretty close to an hour at this point. Can you believe it?
No, that's
time flies when you're having
fun. So is there anything that you guys want to mention? What do you think has changed significantly? Obviously, you know, you guys have a blog, so you guys now are looking at marketing differently or attracting new customers. But what do you think has changed? And what do you guys, you guys have been around, 5 years now, right?
Yeah.
What do you think is going to be different in the next 5 years?
That is a good question. I want to say end deliverables will be a lot different. I think we're going to use our same fundamentals, but we're going to have new technology and new challenges we're going to have to figure out. Right. And then we're going to have to figure out how to get those to the developers and because we do retail renderings as well. Like how will retail be affected by augmented reality and stuff like that? I see it happening. It's kind of like when I first started out, I had to learn every single piece of software I could. Mm-hmm. But now I feel like I need to learn more ways to deliver the end message, the VR, the AR, the drones, everything else. Mm-hmm. It's more
the deliverable platform.
The deliverable platform. It's not the artistry part of it anymore. Like, yeah, I've been doing it for years. Now it's like, what container can I put that in to give it to you so that tells the best story?
Mm.
And I think those containers are going to change over the next 5 years. I mean, it's already changed in 2 years.
That's the really challenging part for us to forecast. What is that going to be? On the other side, for our artists, the process is different too. To get to the art, in the end, the art is the same, but the process is actually getting easier.
And how's that?
The technology is faster. It's things are much more optimized. I mean, I remember doing renderings back before there was GI, and so we'd have to make things look a certain way. And now it's, you know, so much of it's figured out in some ways for the artists.
Those guys photorealism is a solved problem.
Yeah, those guys at V-Ray are pretty good.
So things are, you think that their lives are, iterating is going to be faster, right?
Right.
Right.
And, but do you think that those that architects are going to start doing more renderings because of the technology, or do you think that you guys are still have a very important role to play here?
I think architects may end up doing stills, a lot more stills, while we're then taking that to the you know, the VR realms,
but they don't,
the
augmented
realms. But the thing that won't change is the storytelling process. And I think, you know, there's a creativity involved that still needs someone to think about placement and you know, set dressing and what is it we're trying to communicate and what are you trying to sell. And I, you know, I think maybe we'll be able to spend more time on that portion of it. You will always be designing. Mm-hmm. You know, the computer can do a lot of things itself, but you have to kind of think about, step away from the technology and say, all right, what am I trying to do here? You know, mm-hmm. what is the story I'm trying to do? Is, you know, what's the mood I'm trying to create? What's, and I think for our artists, that's something they have, you know, they can do great renderings, but let's step back and let's learn how do we, you know, how do, maybe we need to become better storytellers, that type of thing. So
that's, you think what they should do?
Maybe. I mean, I think that's, maybe we'll have more time to do it because right. we won't have to focus so much on the process will be so much faster to create renderings. But obviously architects will always want more renderings. But if we can create better images that are more, you know, evocative or produce, you know, a better emotion for what they want, right. maybe that's all they need. So
yeah,
it's kind of a mixed thing.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. I think that's going to be important. I think story is going to be one of the most important things that people need to consider when they think about ArcViz.
Yeah, it's going to translate into everything. VR, right. AR,
yep.
drone shit. I mean, there's whatever that story is, it's going to be the you know, the foundation for everything that we're doing pushing forward.
Right.
I mean, that's the underlying foundation that keeps this whole ArcViz community up.
Yeah.
Standing up. So
absolutely. Yeah. All right. Well, cool, guys. Obviously, you can go to tiltpixel.com if you want to find out more yes. for you guys. but it's been great being here in Houston, SAI, and hearing about your process. So I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.